Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. I am your host, as always, Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. Let me remind you that we are streaming live on biz1190.com, and today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com, so check us out. Here on Driven to Business, we like to talk about entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial spirits. We like to talk about success. We also like to talk about failures, but we really do enjoy talking about entrepreneurs, what makes them tick, and so forth. You know, if I was looking for a good restaurant, I always want to talk to a fat guy and see who ate there, and not a skinny guy. And if I'm looking for financial advice, I want to talk to someone that knows how to make money. And if we're looking for business advice and entrepreneurial advice, you talk to a guy like our guest today, Glenn Meekum. Glenn, welcome to Driven to Business.
Hey, thanks, Eddie. Great to be with you.
Glenn, you have had an incredible career. You're a successful technology entrepreneur. You're also a venture capitalist and a conservative talk show host, which, by the way, airs right here at 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday on our sister station, 920 a.m. here in Atlanta.
And also on Biz 1190 WAFS in Atlanta Sundays at 4 to 6 p.m. too.
Oh wow, absolutely. Yeah. Well, great, Glenn. You're a graduate of the Harvard Business School. You have a long and successful career in business. I'm always interested in talking to someone like you. What got you attracted to the business of business in the first place?
That's a great question, Eddie. I guess I don't always think about that, but. My dad was in business. My grandfather was a guy who'd been in worked for a major corporation, kind of pulled himself up out of poverty and got a good job with a company and was in business. And then my father was much more entrepreneurial. He worked for a series of businesses, building them. But I guess when I was about 13 or 14, I started my first business, which was a lawn cutting business. And at that age, I ended up having about 10 different lawns I cut and had to deal with convincing people that I could do a good job cutting their lawn, and I had to actually deliver, and then I had to collect the money, and I had to make sure the lawnmowers were greased and I had the gasoline and all that good stuff. If I hired another kid, I had to make sure they were competent. And I really liked in those early years being my own boss. And then I had a painting business in the summers during college, and I had a little retail operation for a short time in my 20s. And I always liked working for myself. Now, I started a career, I was, from my family background and then my own entrepreneurial experiences, I liked delivering, developing a product or service, delivering that, being responsible, and making the money from it. I always was attracted to that. And then I pursued kind of a dual strategy. When I got out of college, I had a military scholarship in college, and I was in the Army for a while. But Then when I got done with that, I was trying to get very good jobs in business, trying to build a corporate career. But then I was always looking to see if I could find a really big opportunity to go for, and to kind of jump the corporate ship, start a business that I could really build. And I was always pursuing this dual track of a good resumeable career working for big companies, gaining experience, but at the same time looking for that entrepreneurial opportunity.
I was reading on the internet about the company that you founded, Free Markets, which is a very interesting business. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so then basically I got my MBA and I started working for a consulting firm called McKinsey, and then I went to General Electric. This is way back when in the 90s. And I learned along the way, one principle I learned, and heard this for the first time in business school, but learned it along the way myself too, is that the way you find the best entrepreneurial ideas is not sitting home on your couch watching TV or with your earbuds in your ears listening to your iPod. The way you find the best business opportunities is to be out there in the world. And I was working for this consulting firm, McKinsey, and I was doing a study for a major company, and we were employed to help them reduce their purchasing cost. And I learned that, wow, if you put real effort into purchasing, finding better suppliers, specifying your needs better, really understanding, and these were things like plastic parts and metal parts and all kinds of things like that. If you really put effort into purchasing, you could save a lot of money. And then when I went to GE, I did some work in purchasing, and I just saw that opportunity that, wow, we could use the internet. This is 1994. We could use the internet along with this knowledge of purchasing and supplier research, and we could create a whole new kind of marketplace and a way to save major corporations money by creating downward price competition between suppliers bidding for business across the internet. And I came up with that idea in 1994, and I was still at GE, but it was a combination of what I learned over the last couple of jobs. And then I basically decided to leave GE and start my own business, which was called Free Markets, and I started it in 1995.
And you guys have grown tremendously. I was thinking while you were talking, one of my favorite guys was the late Zig Ziglar, and he always had a saying that no one ever stumbles over anything sitting down, which is basically what you just said about getting these great entrepreneurial ideas. You have to be out there mixing it up.
That's exactly right. To
get them.
Exactly right. So, yeah, and we did. We got that off the ground. And the nice thing, too, about it, if you're out there looking at things and learning from the job you're in and learning from the experiences you're having, is that's how you test things, too. So I knew when I started Free Markets, I knew that if we created the software and the service to automate this decision-making process, this purchasing process of corporations, I knew we could save them a lot of money. And it was really, really hard to start that business. It was hard to get people to pay attention. It was hard to get those first customers. It was hard to build the software. But I knew there was a market for what we were doing because of my prior experience. So we were able to get it started. And I started it in 1995, had only $16,000 of revenue the first year. By the fourth year, 1999, we had almost $23 million of revenue. We took the business public. This was Free Markets. We took it public at the height of the internet bubble. And it was ridiculous, but we had we went public first week of December 1999, within 4 weeks had a $13 billion market cap.
Wow.
And then unfortunately for me, or maybe, I don't know, maybe this was God's will, maybe this was fortunate, but the stock market, of course, crashed. The internet crash happened in March of 2000. So our company went from a, you know, $10, $12, $13 billion market cap down to about $2 billion. And then in the fall of 2000, we crashed again and went all the way down to a $500 million market cap, and got to much more realistic valuations after that. But it was quite a thing to live through with that whole internet bubble and being a company that went public during it and being a CEO of a publicly traded company at that time. It was quite an experience.
I have no experience. I'm a small business guy, Glenn. I have no experience whatsoever in riding a balloon like that. That had to be both exhilarating and terrifying, I would think, as it took off like that.
Yes, exhilarating and terrifying. I think that's a good description. It's one thing. It just challenges who you really are. You know, I'm very passionate about the fact that if you're in business, you want to be ambitious, you want to build a great big business, you want to make a lot of money, you want to serve customers really well, you want to serve your investors really well, you want to have a great environment for your employees. All that's really good, but all those things are great to work for, and making a lot of money is a great thing to work for. But if that's the only thing you're working for,
right,
then you're going to fail, because somebody always has more money, somebody's always got a better, you know, there's always somebody better or bigger or faster or whatever than you. And if that's what you're living for, you're going to be disappointed. And that's where, I know for me, I've got a wonderful wife and I've got five kids and I'm a churchgoer. I believe in God. And I tell you what, those are the things that kept me sane during that huge tumult of the internet bubble.
You know, I'm just sitting here just so enjoying hearing you say that. You know, Glenn, I think when I grew up as a kid and I would see successful business people, and even honestly when I began my career working for other folks, I think I used to think that money was a goal. And I actually used to sit down when I was working as just a salesperson for someone. I would sit down and I'd put out goals. My goals were always, I want to make this much money next year. That was my goal. And most of the time, I made those goals, but then I was sort of surprised at how that was like, you'd do it, and then it was like, well, so what? You know, it just wasn't that fulfilling after you got there. And I think that's what you're talking about. And it amazes me when I talk to successful business people, and you're not the only one that says this. You know, money's important to people, but it's kind of it's an unworthy goal as a standalone goal, isn't it?
Yes, it's very important. It's important because on an absolute level, we want to achieve and be able to have more resources and more freedom and more independence and money and be able to do more for our families. And so money is really, really important. I won't deny that. But, yeah, if it's a standalone goal, you're going to fail because you'll never have enough money.
The name escapes me. You may remember someone who's pretty famous for saying one time that he didn't like, it was a very wealthy guy, he didn't like money really, but it did seem to calm his, it was Joe Louis, the boss who said it, Joe Louis, he didn't like money really, but it did seem to calm his nerves. I think
that's probably right. Yeah, that's probably right. So it's a balance, right? I'm a capitalist. I'm a free marketeer. That's why I called my company Free Markets. I believe in private property and,
right.
And you know what, the integrity and the honesty of private property, people working hard for their own benefit, their family's benefit. And, of course, Adam Smith had it right in 1776 with Wealth of Nations. When everybody's out there working really hard under the law, ethically, for their own private gain, the invisible hand kicks in and it benefits everyone. And that's been proven over and over again for hundreds of years now. But there's another dimension to it, too, which is that if you are out there seeking that private gain, you know, in collaboration with other people to build the company, build the business, whatever it is, then it is really important to have those things like family, like your belief in God, other you know, even more important things than money and success.
You're absolutely right. I share those views with you 100%. You know, after the break, I want to talk to you a moment about being a venture capitalist, because you're a free marketeer and you are a capitalist, and you're also a venture capitalist, and you're a lot more than that. You've started a number of successful companies in addition to having a successful radio program and being a columnist and everything. I read a number of your columns in preparation for the interview here today, but just in general, I just wonder how did you intend to start out as a venture capitalist? Is that something you just sort of got into after starting Free Markets, or is that your goal all along to do that?
We have about a minute. No, I reached a quandary. I was so successful with Free Markets, and there was a time there where I was worth an insane amount of money, you know, over $1 billion at the bubble, during the bubble, and it was all on paper. I didn't get to sell a single share because I was all locked up, and then it was only after the crash and everything that I finally got to start selling some shares. So I did very, very, very well, but not well enough where I was going to hang up my cleats, so to speak, and never work again. You know, I wanted to, and I mean, I could have retired, but I wanted to keep working. I was a very young man, and I wanted to set a great example for my children of hard work. Plus, I wanted to contribute more. And so I really kind of faced the situation of, because I took Free Markets public in 1999, then I sold it in 2004 to another publicly traded company, and I left. And then I had to decide what to do next.
Let me finish talking to you after the break about that. We're talking, you're on Driven to Business. Our guest today is a very interesting Glenn Meekum. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We'll be right back. Stick around. She held him up and he held up. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here talking with entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and conservative talk show host Glenn Meekum, which, by the way, you can find Glenn at Glenn Meekum. That's Glenn, M-E-A-K-E-M, one word, glennmeekum.com. Go there and check that out. Today's program will be podcast, by the way, on eddiemayfield.com. So take advantage of that as well. Glenn, right before the break, before I had to rudely interrupt you there, we were talking about the idea of that you didn't intend to become a venture capitalist. You just sort of got into it. Can you pick that up again for us?
Yeah, so I sold this company. Had a tremendous amount of experience, 10-year run. You know, not only my prior business experience, but it was about 10 years from between when I founded Free Markets and when I finally sold it. We went public in the middle. I was a public company CEO for four or five years. And I had all this experience, and I decided, well, what was I going to do next? And I was tempted to go into politics, but decided not to do that for a whole bunch of reasons. And I thought, well, you know what I'll do is, instead of trying to start one, I didn't want to go work for somebody else at a big company. And I said, instead of starting one company and having all the risk, all my eggs in one basket, I'll start a venture firm, and I'll invest in a group of companies, and I'll advise them, and I'll use my experience to advise a group of companies. So that's why I became a venture capitalist, and I raised a $75 million venture fund. So I went out and got commitments from all different kinds of investors worth a total of $75 million. And we set up a classic traditional venture capital firm, my partners and I, and we started investing in early stage technology companies, mostly internet companies, but that were based all over the United States.
you know, you had some incredible success in that as well, just reading some of like Kiva Systems, for instance, which you sold to Amazon and a number of others that you did. I mean, if a company like mine, you know, my company's in the electronic motor drive business, and we're in three different states, and we're pretty much going to be where we are, I think. But if I decided I wanted to franchise and go big, and I was trying to attract someone like Glenn Meekham to perhaps invest money in us, what kind of questions would you be asking me?
Oh, that's a great question. So, yeah, well, I think pretty much venture capitalists are all looking for pretty much the same thing. It's number one, is this opportunity, is there a lot of growth?
Right.
You know, you're not looking to invest in a flat business or a very moderate or mature business. You want a business that's going to grow a lot. So in your case, gee, if there's a franchising story here, gee, could you take it from 3 stores to 200 stores? Is there, if it's going to just double or triple, that's not enough to justify the risk a venture capitalist is going to take. So it's got to be a lot of growth. So can it grow a lot? Two, and part of that is the opportunity a good idea? Is it a really, really good idea, really, really good service or product that's compelling? And is the market big? If the market's really large, then you got this big growth potential. So there's two things. Third thing is, are the margins there? Is this a narrow, small margin business, or is this a really profitable, big margin business? This is one reason why VCs are so much into the internet these days, and have been now for 15 years, is that the internet's this new thing, new huge potential, new market. So there's a chance to start new things and grow them, but also the margins are very, very high. So eventually, and Facebook is an example, Google's an example. Eventually, when a business gets to scale, it just can print money because it's very low cost to run it. So you know, just to review, big compelling product, big market idea, very good margins, and then the fourth and most important thing is the management team, the CEO leader of this business, and the team he or she has around them. Are they really, really capable, great people? Are they honest? Are they hardworking? Are they good decision makers? Are they good leaders? And, you know, a lot of times there may be a good business opportunity, but if the leadership is bad, it's going to fail. So you need really, really good leaders, and you need to believe in the people you're investing in as a VC.
Let's talk about leadership just for a moment, because I often tell people I may not be a very good leader, but I'm an awfully avid student of leadership. I enjoy watching how people lead and how they are able to be successful at leading other people. And there are a lot of different styles. What's your style? Could you describe it?
For me, it comes down to a couple things. Number one, lead by example.
Right.
So I was early in my career. I mentioned being an Army officer. I had an ROTC scholarship in college, and I did a lot of officer training. And then I actually served in the first Gulf War. And so I had this military background, and I think I always was a student of leadership and was a good leader before I ever entered the military. But I will tell you, no place teaches leadership like I think the United States Army and the United States Marine Corps. And so a couple of key principles I learned. One is that you always lead by example. You know, if you're not willing, you know, the leader always, and this is a military example, but it applies to a lot of things. You don't ask people to do stuff you're not willing to do yourself. You know, if you got to set the lead, you got to be out in front. You got to lead by example. Another thing you've got to do is you can't dally on decisions. You can't delay. You've got to get. But what a lot of organizations do in business is they have analysis paralysis.
Exactly.
They take forever to make a decision. There's never, let's do another analysis. Let's do another market research study. Let's wait another 6 months before we make a decision. You know, when people's lives are on the line in the military, you got to take the information you have. You got to make a decision, and they teach you this over and over again. And it's true. It's true in the military. It's true in business. The worst decision you can make is no decision.
Right.
Even if you make the wrong decision, make a decision, go for it, and then if you find out quickly that it's not the right decision, correct it, make a change. You know, make a bad decision, realize it, face the truth, and then make a change. It's and in the technology world, Silicon Valley, they call that fail fast. That's a military principle. They teach that in the Army and the Marine Corps. Fail fast. Make a decision. Do the best you can. If it's the wrong decision, face the fact and then change it. So it's and then lead by example. Make a decision. Fail fast. Another thing that going along with that was this thing called the 70% rule, where, you know, you're never going to have 100% of the information to make a decision. So make it, get 70% of the information, analyze it, make a decision, and go for it. And those are a lot of just kind of general leadership principles. But then my leadership style, I get into this real thing. I lead by character traits and values. So I want people on my team who are honest. And in order to be honest, that means you face the hard truths. You know, you face the real facts and the hard truths. And in order to do that, you got to be courageous. You know, it takes a lot of courage to tell the truth and face up to the facts.
Right.
But it also takes graciousness. You know, if you're gonna be a person who's honest enough and courageous enough to tell the truth, you better be gracious with people. You know, my mom used to say a little bit of, you know, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. You know, that was an old phrase, but it's true. So I'm very values driven as well in how I lead, and I think it works.
I'm sure it does. I think I hear great things about you. I had a chance to talk with one of your folks up there, and was just telling me a little bit, actually an email conversation, telling me a little bit about your leadership style. And it's always interesting what people that work for folks say about them. And when the people that work for you are saying in casual conversation, not being prompted, they're commenting on what a good leader someone is, you can pretty well write it down that person's a pretty good leader, because people don't, you know, people may say what they think they're supposed to say in answer to a question, but they don't volunteer information about people's
yep.
leadership unless they actually do believe it.
I'll tell you one other thing that's kind of you to say, but one other thing that I've found in leadership, especially as an entrepreneur, you're not, you know, when you go lead a big established business, a business that's been there for, I don't care whether it's a huge company or a family-owned smaller company, if it's been there a long time, people believe that the revenue is going to be there next year
right.
and next month, and the payroll is going to be there and everything else. When you start something new, you've got to have a level of determination and stick-to-itiveness where you're going to overcome huge obstacles, because it's hard to get new customers. It's hard to get a new brand name across. It's hard to communicate a whole new product or a whole new service. And so you've got to have tremendous, and you've got to, there are moments where you go home at night as the leader, as a founder, or a CEO of a new company, and you're not sure whether it's all going to work out.
Right.
And you've got to have the gumption and the determination to look yourself in the mirror and say, we're going to make this work. I'm going to make this work. And then you got to go in the next day and look people in the eye and say, don't worry, we're going to make this work. So you've got to have this determination. And that's a big part of leadership, too. It goes back to the military example. You know, if you're leading troops up that hill, you better be able to look them in the eye and say, we're going to go up that hill. We're going to make it. I'm going to be with you. You know, I'm going to lead. We're going to make it together, but we're going to make it. Don't worry, we're going to make it. Even when you're not sure yourself whether you're really going to make it, I mean, you got to have this level of determination and confidence.
I agree. It's so interesting to hear you talk about that. The guy that I kind of learned business from out in Texas, an entrepreneur, used to tell me I would always be making a decision and sort of second guessing. And he would say, hey, look, Eddie, just look ahead and move along. Don't stand back and worry about the mistake you made. Just correct it and move along. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Our guest today is Glenn Meekham, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the third segment of today's Driven to Business. As a reminder, we're streaming live on biz1190.com. We'll be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. Our guest today is Glenn Meekham. Glenn, you had talked about values quite a bit here, and I noticed there, even on your website, and I went there and looked at them. I've done the same thing with our company, so I do like that. I recently watched a rerun of a series on the History Channel about the men that made America, you know, like J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and these guys.
Yeah, I saw that.
It was really pretty interesting to look at. And, you know, they were, like all human beings are, they were both good and bad at the same time. You know, all of us are flawed in one way, but they certainly, this would be a very different country than it was now. But they, you know, they did in the end of their life at least put some good values to their business. And so I think with you, I would admit that values. I didn't mean to say values and Baptists go together, although I am one. But values. My pastor would be glad to hear me say that. I think
probably not too bad a combo, right?
but anyway, are you optimistic in general? You know, it seems like those days is pretty easy, and I even hear a lot of conservatives now. I know you're a conservative talk show host. A lot of conservatives now seem to be kind of down on the country, like our best days are behind us, and there's not a Rockefeller around anymore. There's not a Carnegie around anymore. Now China's going to take over the world. And what's your take on that?
Well, I'm actually more. I'm sensitive to the same thing. I do a radio show every weekend, and again, I'm on Biz 1190 every Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. If your listeners want to listen to me Sunday evening, and of course at glennmeekum.com. But a lot of my callers, a lot of people are down, and I think that this, when Barack Obama won the second term, a lot of people did, that really kicked a lot of people in the teeth, because yep. they really didn't feel like he was doing a good job, and they really felt he was taking America in the wrong direction. And then, a majority of Americans or a majority of voters voted for him, and it was a really hard thing to take. And a lot of people were depressed for a long time. And of course, they're not happy with the way the country's gone since. You look at the economy, still sluggish. The tax rates have gone up. The EPA has gotten more and more control over things. Our foreign situation, we've shown weakness in the world for 6 years now. And you can see the world has started to become a much more dangerous place, from exactly. from Eastern Europe to the South China Sea to Iran to Venezuela. I mean, it goes on and on. But I will say this. The United States of America, my beloved country, our beloved country, has been through worse times. The 1930s were much worse than this. The Great Depression, and not just the Great Depression, I could go in, we don't have time to talk about it, but that was largely a self-inflicted wound, just like our wounds today are self-inflicted, but it was worse. I will tell you, you go back to the time of the Civil War, the war between the states, and that was a very, very, very difficult time.
Right.
And, you know, every time we've gone through a very difficult time, because of the spirit of the American people, and because of our freedom, because of the rule of law, the fact that there was a structure where great people could start new things and create value, we've come back. And I believe we will come back. I think we've got to win some real political battles here, and we've got to educate young people about the value of freedom and the rule of law and our Constitution. But I think we can win that battle. I do. I'm not pessimistic. Like many entrepreneurs, I am a natural optimist, and I'm a little bit seasoned. I've taken my lumps. I've been knocked down. I've gotten back up many times in my life, both literally and figuratively. But I'm the kind of guy who gets back up, ready to fight some more, and I'm willing to be optimistic.
Then you wrote an article that I read. I found very interesting. You were talking about why, because there's so much comparison, and I've heard this over and over from people about comparing us to Rome, how that, you know, we're like Rome now, kind of fat and lazy, and so therefore we're inevitably going to fall as Rome did. You made a great, I never really saw anybody do this, what you did before, but you set down three reasons that Rome fell, having to be that the aristocrats paid no taxes, that Roma's citizens didn't serve in the military, and in Rome's law and order broke down, and you compare that to the U.S. and you say we're nothing like that.
Right. I mean, we have some, people don't realize we are a very fundamentally strong society. There's things that could crack and ruin any society, but Rome went through a long decline for many, many reasons, and one of the key reasons was that it just did not really have, it had criminal law. You know, you couldn't get away with stealing, all the goods out of someone's shop, or kidnapping, you know, there was slavery and all kinds of terrible stuff like
right.
that. But you couldn't get away with, kidnapping the daughter of a merchant who lived down the street. I mean, there was basic rule of law and order at the kind of criminal level, but at the senior levels of society, this concept of the law being equal, all people being equal before the law, did not exist. The concept of legal changes of power between different officials didn't exist. So there was just at some level it was a dictatorship with no rules and no laws for the ultimate dictators, and that was just one of the many problems. I mean, Rome was a very, very, very juvenile, very early society compared to what we have, and yeah, we have our problems, but. And this is why, when on my radio show, the thing I'm most worried about in terms of the Obama administration's behavior is its attitude towards the rule of law. Because
right.
the Marxist idea is that the end justifies the means. The Marxist
right.
idea is that, oh, we Marxists, we leftists, we have all the answers, and whatever we need to do to inflict our answers upon society, the end justifies the means, because we're right, and it doesn't matter what we do to get there. It doesn't matter who we kill, what law we trample on. What the the American Constitution, you go back to John Locke and Jeffersonian principles and just the whole group of founders of our country, you know, really who were building on Enlightenment ideas. The key idea is that the means are everything. It's not about the end. It's about how you get there. It's about the process. It's about the fact that there's checks and balances and there's accountability and everybody's under the law. You know, the president is under the law. Everybody's accountable. The fact is the means are everything. And this is the thing I think that is disturbing about what's going on now, is that these chinks in the rule of law. That being said, our courts are not perfect, too many liberal judges, but you know what? The courts are a very resilient institution. I believe Congress is a resilient institution, and that the Constitution itself is resilient. And I believe that if we educate more and more people about the importance of the rule of law, the importance of the American Constitution, that we will hold it all together in the long run. I believe it's there. And frankly, it's in everybody's self-interest. Going back to Adam Smith, it's in everybody's self-interest, because the more we have a set of rules that everyone has to obey, the more prosperous, powerful, extreme, you know, successful we're going to be, and the more free we're going to be, and that's good for everybody. So I think in the long run we're going to win the battle, but it goes to prove, you know, Ronald Reagan said that freedom is something that has to be won in every generation, and that's what we have to do, and that means educating people, and doggone it, this public school system is giving all kinds of propaganda to kids all over America, and we've got to do. That's why I'm on the radio every week. That's why I spend the time. I don't make any money on it. I spend the time because I'm trying to do my little part to help educate Americans about what we need to do to make our society strong.
You know, Glenn, one of the going along with what you said, I think one of the great examples of rule of law in the United States, and the election could probably be used as a good example. I was bitterly disappointed when Barack Obama got reelected. I thought he didn't deserve a second term. But we all accepted the results of the election. We didn't go march on Washington and try to go round up a militia and go up there and take over the Capitol. We accepted the vote and didn't like it, but we accepted it. And that has a lot to say about our American culture, the fact of how resilient we can be because of being a nation of law.
Yes, agreed 100%.
And even, you know, I've read before, the difference in the American Revolution and the French Revolution, for instance, which some people try to compare, but the French Revolution was basically a mob action in the street, and the American Revolution was a well-thought-out change of government that very reasoned men thought out how they were going to do this, and yes, it precipitated a war, but you know, we had the Declaration of Independence, which laid out the moral basis for that, which we all went by, even before we raised any arms. We did make a legal document saying this is what we believe and this is what we think, how we think natural law works here in this country. Hey, yes. I had the pleasure of interviewing, and you may know him, a guy named Dan Witt, that's the president of the International Tax and Investment Center. I don't know anybody that spends more time it would drive me crazy, really, in the weeds of tax policy as Dan does. But you know, Dan says that good tax policies in this country would reinstitute growth almost instantly. We have about a minute. You got a comment on that?
Yeah, I agree. Right now, I pay about 50 cents on the dollar. Every dollar I earn, about 50 cents goes to taxes, between federal income tax, state income tax, local income tax, sales taxes, property taxes. Those are the big five. And then even telecom taxes, gas taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you know what? When people are having to pay 50 cents on the dollar to a government that is then taking that money and making tens of millions of people dependent and who are not standing on their own two feet and not contributing to the society, you got a big problem. So, yeah, we need to ration the amount of money government gets so it gets more efficient, and we need to let people like me and you and everybody else keep more of their own hard-earned money, because it's our money, not the government's. And then, yeah, we spend and invest money a whole lot better than the government does. And if you – right now with me, if I could just keep – 70 cents on the dollar instead of 30 cents on the dollar, believe me, that 20 cents, I could invest that. I could do a lot of good things. I could do a lot better with that 20 cents than the government's going to do with it. And if, and there's people like me all over the country, millions of us. And oh, by the way, if we could be investing that 20 cents a lot better than the government is, then a lot better than the government's wasting and spending, the economy would grow very, very fast.
You're absolutely right. You know, it just seems to me like that is such a natural conclusion you should draw. You know, you hear people complaining about, well, there'll be some story come out of where they've just some incredible waste of money by the government. And you know, my thing with that is that, okay, instead of getting so upset about that, just understand that by its very nature, it's not that the government is populated, not that everyone who works for the government is a crook. They're certainly not. There's good people there. But it's going to be inefficient. So let's make it as little as possible. We need government. Let's don't have it any bigger than it needs to be. Let's don't give it any more money than it needs to have. And let the rest of us who can be efficient, let us do that part, which we can do a lot better. You're listening to Driven to Business. Our guest today is a very interesting Glenn Mecham. By the way, you can find Glenn at Glenn, M-E-A-K-E-M, glennmecham.com. Go there and check him out. You're listening to Driven to Business. One more segment to come. Don't go anywhere. Be right back. Welcome back to the final edition of this week's Driven to Business. As always, I'm Eddie Mayfield. Very glad you're here. Our guest today is Glenn Mecham. Glenn, you've recently started another venture, fairly recently at least, called Forever. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Forever.com. It goes back to the theme of recognizing a need. So when I got back from the Gulf, I was in the Gulf War in 1991. When I got back, I've been away for many months, and my wife and I decided to just take the summer off, drive around and see family, and we did. We drove around and we bunch of reunions around the country with different people, and we also took video of our living grandparents at the time. They're all gone now, but then you know, of course, I dived into my career, free markets, all this other stuff I talked about. Diane and I had 5 kids, but I got all the way, you know, wind the clock forward over 20 years and get all the way to 2012, 2 years ago. And I decided, okay, I want to take a look. I want to figure out a place where I can keep all those videos and photos I took way back then and all the family videos and especially pictures from way back earlier. And then all the stuff Diane and I have of our kids and we're creating every day. I asked the question, where do I go? Having all that stuff on a machine, a backup drive in the living room or on a machine or, you know, things, computers are always crashing, or if it's in a photo album, it can get lost. And, you know, Hurricane Sandy last year or 2 years ago, my goodness, people lost all these tornadoes just this last week in Alabama in the South. You know, people losing all their photographs and stuff. The albums get washed away. And I said, well, how is there a permanent solution where I can go save all my stuff in the cloud, in the internet cloud, where it's secure, trustworthy, where I can save it, and it's there for a long, long time? And I went looking for that, and it didn't exist. So I said, well, that's a big opportunity. So I decided to create Forever.com, and I was able to buy the domain Forever.com, and we created named the company that, and I raised a whole lot of money from I invested money myself, but also a number of people I know, and I went out and raised a whole lot of money. It's about $18 million total I've raised, and we have a very, very big, very serious effort, and we've created this company over the last almost 2 years now. And basically, that's it. You can go to, your listeners can go to forever.com, the word forever, it's our brand, forever.com, and check it out and read all about it. But this is a place where you can upload and store and share all your most important photos and videos and stories. Actually, videos coming out in a few more months, but all your most important photos right now and stories, and you can upload documents and things like that. And it's a place where you can just capture all that family memory. And even there's an iPhone application. Every time you take a photo on your iPhone, you can upload it directly or upload a group of photos right to your Forever site. And the big thing is that the stuff is there permanently. So you become a permanent member. You pay a very reasonable amount every month. And instead of just paying a subscription fee and it goes away. It's like rent to own. You pay a little bit every month, and over the course of 3 years, you actually own your site, and your photos and your documents and your video eventually are stored there permanently.
You know, Vicki and I have talked about that many times. We have four children, and you may have had the same experience we've had. You know, you took pictures galore of the first child, and then a lot of pictures of the next child, and a fair amount of pictures of the next child. And our youngest daughter, Rebecca, kids us that we completely ripped her off and quit taking pictures. It's not exactly true, but we certainly didn't have the numbers out of them. But you know, it does come down to where you're trying to store them somewhere. But, you know, Glenn, in this business here, you're fighting some big boys in this, Google and people like that. Are you standing up to them?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's nobody, you know, Google, everything Google does is about data mining you. So,
right.
So you put something on Google Plus, and they're literally data mining you and then selling access to you.
Right.
Right. It's not private. Facebook, same thing. When you upload something to Facebook, any photo you upload, they compress it down to nothing, and then they data mine you and they sell access to you.
Right.
And then a lot of the commodity internet storage sites are just they're just temporary and they're commodity. You know, what we do is we have triple backup all around the world, so that your stuff is triple backed up and it's encrypted, and we have a privacy policy where there's no advertising, no data mining. You own every single thing you upload to forever.com. You own. And then we have a contract with you where we give you a guarantee. We say you'll be able to save and share. It's private sharing. If you want it to be totally private, it's totally private. But if you want to share with your friends and family, you can do that, or share. And even I've got some veterans, World War II veterans, on the site who want their stories to be public, and so you can make it public too. But basically, you control, you own, you control, and then we guarantee you that your stuff will be there for your lifetime, plus 100 years, guaranteed, with a goal of many, many years longer than that. And the reason for that is when people are joining us and they pay, they become a member and they start paying for their permanent storage, the money they're paying for the storage goes into what's called the Forever Guarantee Fund, and that guarantee fund is like, it's a financial instrument. It's like an endowment, and it's invested in a globally diversified portfolio, and that money, you know, it's generating income and growth every year, and then we take a little bit of that, 4% every year, to pay for the storage and pay for the bandwidth, the sharing. So it's, what we're doing is very, very unique, and we got this great, great, fabulous name, forever.com. So, yeah, we're indirectly, nobody's doing exactly what we're doing. We're indirectly competing against the best people in Silicon Valley and the best people in the world on the internet. But, you know, I did that before with free markets, and we're up to the challenge.
Glenn, you really are a technology entrepreneur. Just sort of taking the business hat off for a moment, it does me sometimes. Are you just astonished at how connected we all are today sometimes? Does it just amaze you?
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean,
it's hard to believe, isn't it? I mean, it's sometimes just, I think back even to in 1988 when I founded our business. If there was an internet, I didn't know anything about it. I mean, you know, maybe there was one, but I hadn't seen it. And now so much of our business comes from the internet. It really is a blessing. It's an amazing time to be in business, isn't it?
Well, it's an amazing time to be alive, and the thing is, when you I love to study history. One reason I thought of this forever idea is that I really care about family, not only
right.
broader history, but family history.
Right.
I think everybody, I say, you know, everybody's, you know, everybody needs to be remembered. Every life needs to be celebrated, and every family needs to have its history, and kids and grandkids and great-grandkids need to grow up knowing where they came from and knowing the values and the beliefs and the lessons learned from the past. But when you look at that broadly, there's challenges in every time. I mean, the 1880s were a terrible time. There was a terrible depression.
Right.
The 1900s were a terrible time. There was a terrible depression. 1914, 100 years ago, was the beginning of World War I. World War I was a terrible time. You know, so there's always, history is full of terrible times, and I think that's comforting to know that and know that, wow, there's challenges in our time, but there's also this incredible progress and really good things going on too. So, yeah, it's amazing how connected we are. That has a bad side. You know, online pornography is a real problem. Kids seeing and being exposed to things that they shouldn't be, that's a real problem. There's a negative side to it, but boy, there's a real positive side to it as well.
Glenn, this is going to totally, this is an unfair time, but in about a minute, one of the things I'm interested in, I know you are too, it's high tech and it's not high tech, but you know, the U.S., we have the chance to be energy independent now with natural gas and the stores of oil. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, it's a no-brainer. So I live in western Pennsylvania, the Pittsburgh area. We have this amazing deposit of natural gas.
You know, we're burning gas in Atlanta now from Pennsylvania. You know this, I guess.
Yeah, it's 8,000, literally where I'm standing, 8,000 feet down is wow. It's a huge amount of gas. And we're finding the gas and the oil now from the source rock. It's information technology. It's moonshot technology applied to geology. That's what it is.
You're exactly
it's
right.
It's extremely safe, and it's extremely high-tech, and it's American-developed, and it's American-produced, and it's a fabulous blessing for our society. And the fact that there are people who are against it is just absolutely irrational.
By the way, it is a great opportunity for both American investors and American businesses to capitalize and take care of this. Glenn, you've been a great guest. Thank you so much for being here. Let me remind everyone that Glenn is right here in Atlanta on the radio. He's on 920 AM from 4 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday, and also here on Sundays from 4 to 6. He's right here on Biz 1190. Glenn, thank you so much for being here.
Great. Hey, thanks so much, Eddie. Take care.
You guys go to glennmeekum.com and check him out. And check us out again next week at 11 o'clock. I'm Eddie Mayfield. See you next week.